Hey, Zilpha.
Hey, John.
Where are you going to be on August 6th, 2010?
Well, hopefully with you.
That's right.
Maybe with some other friends.
That's right, because August 6th, 2010 is the Mormon Expression live podcast recording.
Oh, right.
Doors open at 6:30. Recording starts at 7, and reception follows at 8.
Reception, does that include food?
Yes.
I'm so there.
Tasty hors d'oeuvres. Now, the reception will be on the University of Utah campus, Student Union Building in the Crimson Room.
Sounds nice.
Unfortunately, space is limited, so you need to get your ticket reserved. You can get a ticket reserved by sending an email to mail@mormonexpression.com. So we look forward to seeing everybody there. Hey, there's one other thing we want to talk about. You remember what that is?
Sex?
Not sex. It's close enough. It's the first annual Mormon Expression personal essay contest. Do you remember this?
Yes. Everybody who wants to participate can write a an essay, something having to do with Mormonism, and then they need to record it.
Yeah, since this is an audio podcast, what everybody needs to do is record a personal essay, something about them and anything about Mormonism. It needs to be less than 10 minutes long, and you can submit it to us here at the podcast by July 1st. The winner receives what?
Money.
How much?
$100.
That's right, $100. So mosey on over to the website to check out details on the personal essay contest. Get your tickets for the live show, and we'll see you there.
Hello, it's V.
Yes.
Hello, this is Glenn.
How are you, Glenn?
Good. Good. Well, just want to welcome you on to Mormon Expression on behalf
okay.
of John Larson. This is a podcast that is for a Mormon community that define themselves very liberally. There's ex-Mormons, current believers, just people that are interested in, you know, discussing Mormon topics.
And, okay.
So for my background, I studied folklore, and I think I explained this to you in the email that
yes.
I sent to you. And a few weeks ago, I was contacted by a professor at BYU who asked me to do a review, write a review of your book, the 10 Lost Tribes of World History. And as I started reading it, I thought of this podcast. They had done a similar interview with an author on a book on the occult and American history. I thought it would be interesting to get you on and talk a little bit about the Lost Tribes. And I know you don't spend a lot of time on the Mormon piece of it, but I
yes.
think there's some things that this audience would be interested in. So if you could tell a little bit about your background, who you are, and what led you to write a book about the Lost Tribes.
Sure. I was born in Jerusalem, which I think... in hindsight, maybe important to this, maybe important to the book. I also was born to a family of immigrants to Jerusalem. So that may affect it, the idea that I'm interested in questions of immigration and exile and diaspora. Mm-hmm. I'm also trained as a historian of China. And most of my work focuses on the Muslims of China, which in many respects was considered for a very long time a sort of a lost group, because they were always very far away. And China in Islamic and Arab imagination in the Middle Ages was something that is beyond the wars of Gog and Magog, beyond the pale of, you know, the earth and so on. So that made me very much interested in this idea of groups that are somewhat unreachable.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Now, the Muslims of China, as opposed to the Lost Tribes, are a very real problem.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. A very real entity, not a problem, but a very real group of people
mm-hmm.
With history. In addition to that, I'm very much interested in world history, and particularly in ways in which one can write world history from a cultural point of view.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. To find a thread that holds everything together. Most of world historians today work on questions of trade, commerce, economy, international politics and diplomacy and so on. But it's very difficult to find something that is overarching. And in this regard, the 10 lost tribes are interesting because, you know, since they are somewhat expelled from the world, they can provide a very interesting view of the whole world, as a whole. If you follow the discussions about them and the way in which people are, have been talking about them in the past 2000 years, even more than 2000 years. So that's pretty much got me into it. I mean, I am, very close reader of the Bible since childhood. I mean, you can imagine Israeli education put a lot of emphasis on reading the Bible as a way of not only of just reading the Bible, as a way of learning Hebrew. That never left me. So when the opportunity presented itself to write a world history that stems from a biblical topic, I jumped on it.
Right. Okay. You mentioned earlier when you were talking about the Muslims in China, you mentioned Gog and Magog. And, yes. And I saw you returned to that reference several times in your book, and it's familiar to me peripherally. But could you explain a little bit about what is Gog and Magog? I always think of this apocalyptic image.
Yes. That's a very interesting story. I mean, in fact, what we have, Gog and Magog is a very, very mysterious, not very clear, word, name that, appears several times in the Bible. First in the Hebrew Bible, in Ezekiel and Azrael, who talks about Prince Gog, who is associated with all sorts of, catastrophes. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily, by the way, catastrophes that he brings, that Prince Gog, but actually princes, that are brought, onto him. And it is completely unidentifiable. Later on, Gog and Magog enter for some reason that is not yet clear to me. I'm sure that, scholars of the Gospel of John know more about it. They enter the book of Revelation, as Gog and Magog. And they become, as a result of an adaptation of stories about Alexander the Great during the early Middle Ages, even in late antiquity, they become some sort of two important entities that is not yet clear what they are. Are they tribes? Are they peoples? Even monsters who are pushed geographically way east to the end of the world, literally to the end of the world. And there are some sort of, there are some contained behind a wall that, Alexander the Great ostensibly created in order to block them from coming to, our world and, wreak havoc or bring catastrophe to it. I mean, this is an adaptation already of, certain stories that start to emerge after the book of Revelation, you know, bring them into a new incarnation. So in fact, the book of Revelation is the thing that makes them, a catastrophic element, because he reworks these verses from Ezekiel. What happens, later on, I mean, and this is already Arab imagination actually in the 8th century, even in the Quran already begins to rework this further on. Uh-huh. Okay. What happens later on, I mean, that all of these groups, you know, that are lost or associated with the apocalypse and so on are lumped together. So are the lost tribes. Now, if you look at, you know, even contemporary, Muslim writings, then, you know, China is, sometimes known as the land of Yajuj and Majuj, which in Arabic is Gog and Magog is Yajuj and Majuj. So sometimes you can hear that, occurring a lot. And of course, the idea here is that, you know, at some point in the east, there is a wall, right, and that wall or these mountains or something are blocking everybody else, blocking all sorts of entities from coming and bringing apocalypse on our world.
And is that the Alexander thing that was outside of the realm of Alexander, and that's why it's China?
Yes, okay. Very much so. Very much so. I mean, what happens is that the geography of the Alexandrian Empire becomes the geography of our world. Okay. And Alexander is associated, Alexander's role is recasted as the person who basically prevents them from coming, or like fights with them or push them to the east and keep them there. Okay. Now, the issue here is that the end of the world, the term end of the world, is both, you know, the space itself, okay, as in the edge of the world, but also end of the world in terms of time.
Right. Okay.
Okay. So they sit at the end of the world, at the very edge, the very, very end of it, very limit of it, but they also represent the end of the world as a temporality. So if they come, it will literally be the end of the world.
So it's a symbol of impending disaster, impending doom.
Yes.
On that of impending, periphery.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Of impending disaster. And the 10 lost tribes, I mean, this is already a second century when they become lumped to this, they become lumped with this apocalyptic, literature. As I explained in the second chapter of the book and the third chapter of the book, when they become lumped with it, they are simply pushed also together with Gog and Magog. And sometimes they play a positive role and sometimes they play a bad role. Sometimes they are simply there to fight Gog and Magog and keep them from coming
keep
here.
Them away. Okay. Well, yes. I that's fascinating. I think I jumped the gun a little bit on the Gog and Magog question, you had mentioned it. So, how about we start, just with the beginning, you know, how these tribes, who they are and how they became lost.
Okay. Well, I mean, here's one very important thing that guided me all the way through is that, you know, I don't mess with the biblical text and say, well, you know, it's all a tale.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Because, many people take this as truth. And I think at some level, it is truth. Mm-hmm. And in order to write a meaningful history of this story, you need to take it as truth.
Okay.
That said, what we know is that, you know, you have the story of the 12 tribes, and you have a story of a unified kingdom under David and Solomon, and that becomes split, mainly for political reasons, but also as a punishment for Solomon, during his son's time, Rehoboam. So this is, we are now, let's say, in the around of the 9th century, 8th century BCE. And what you have then is two kingdoms. One kingdom is the kingdom of Judea or Judah, which is in the south, and it's a very small kingdom, and archaeologists historically estimate its people to be about 100,000 people, and it is ruled by descendants of the Davidic dynasty, and it's in Jerusalem. The second kingdom is the kingdom that is made of 10 tribes. Okay, in Judah, you have two tribes, you have Judah and Benjamin. In the north, you have a kingdom of Benjamin and of 10 tribes led by the tribe of Ephraim, which is the biggest tribe. And of course, there's all sorts of stories there because, you know, Ephraim is blessed by Jacob in Egypt. Mm-hmm. He's also a descendant of, he's also a son of Joseph, and Joseph is one of the chosen sons of Jacob, is the son of Rachel and so on. So there is an alternative dynasty of chosenness that goes from Jacob through Rachel and Joseph to the tribe of Ephraim, as opposed to the tribe of from Jacob to the tribe of Judah and then the house of David. Mm-hmm. Okay, this is a very important element here because in a way, the leaders of the 10 tribes, they do represent a different messianic thread. Okay, the one that is different than the one that we know. You know, the house of David all the way to Jesus. There's an alternative messianic thread there. Mm-hmm. Now, historically, we know that the 10 tribes were associated with the this is the kingdom of Israel is the kingdom of the 10 tribes, and historically they have problems with the Assyrians. They have problems with the Assyrians because the Assyrians are a very serious empire in Mesopotamia. And they like to make sure that everybody understands that. And they pay attention particularly to strong kingdoms. The kingdom of the 10 tribes is about 300,000 people at the time. It's quite prosperous, unlike the dry and very small kingdom of Judah. We know, for example, that in the 9th century, King Ahab, who is very much is presented in the Bible as a villain, as a sinner, actually he participated in a very serious coalition, a military coalition that's fighting the Assyrians, trying to keep them in the east and preventing them from coming to the Eastern Mediterranean. And he is told to have sent, you know, thousands of soldiers and almost 2,000 chariots to participate in this war. So they were a significant entity and a political entity in the region. But what happened is that when the Assyrians become stronger, they mount a series of expeditions and they basically destroy all the kingdoms that are in the north, that are in the north of Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. If you try to imagine today, then we're talking about southern Turkey, Syria, Lebanon, and northern Israel. Mm-hmm. All this followed to the hands of the Assyrians.
At the beginning, about 720, 721 BC.
We're talking about between 750 to 721.
Okay.
So at the first stage, you know, the kingdom of Israel lose most of its territory. They have to pay tribute, but they remain somewhat independent. Then more territory is annexed. There's another failed expedition, but the final blow comes at the time of Sargon II in 721 BC, where the kingdom of Samaria is destroyed. Mm-hmm. Now, what Sargon does, and we have outside information about this, because he erected two steles that talks about his great victories. I mean, the Assyrians were serious bureaucrats, and they kept most of the bureaucracy there. And this is only discovered in the 19th century. Okay, until the 19th century, we only have the Bible as a source, the main source for all of this. But what we know today is that Sargon basically exiled 27,000 people, a significant number to understood, but not a very serious number. And certainly not the entire group of people of the 10 tribes. Not the entire people are not destroyed. Mm-hmm. Okay. And this is part of, you know, a general policy of the ancient empires of the Middle East, in terms of, you know, it increases the security. If you exile people, you break the backbone of the society. Mm-hmm. Okay, because usually what you exile is the elite, or you exile the people who can make swords, you exile the people who can participate in the military or the leaders and so on. These are the people who get deported. They are moved to other places. And what you have in the remainder is the, sometimes it is the commoners and so on, the people who cannot really mount serious resistance to the imperial power. So first of all, there is an element of punishment in the exile, but also there's an element of, you know, some sort of imperial logic. Okay, you shuffle the populations a little bit, and then you increase the stability in different part of the empire. Okay. And the Bible tells us this story very well. You know, Sargon, in the Bible, it's King Shalmaneser, because there is a mistake there. But the Assyrian king removes part of the population and then brings other people who are exiled from elsewhere to this territory. And if you read Assyrian steles, you can see, wow, they move everybody. They exile from here, they exile from there, you know, all over the Middle East people are exiled. And the way in which it works is, you know, the Assyrian king says, well, I moved these people and I counted them as Assyrians. Basically, they become Assyrian subjects and they are incorporated in the army. And in the case of those who would become later on the lost tribes, then we know that because of names, Hebrew names suddenly popped up in different places in the Assyrian army, we know that there were many of them served as cooks and soldiers maybe in the Assyrian army. Okay. After that happened. But very important for us, no massive exile of 300,000 people or the entire group of the lost tribes was exiled at all. Okay, most of the people actually remained. We have all sorts of evidence, even in the Bible itself, that many of them simply fled to Jerusalem after this conquest.
So the group, the group that would become the ten lost tribes was just a sliver of who had been the northern kingdom.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Okay. Many people simply stay. Many people move to Jerusalem. And we know that, you know, several tens of thousands of people are exiled to Mesopotamia and to different places, to the different places in the empire. This is the story if you rework the biblical narrative with archaeological evidence since the 19th century.
Okay.
This is what you get.
Right. And then you mentioned that there were some other sources that, that came along. That you're talking about the biblical sources and then some the records in the military records. What about some of the apocryphal books and when some of the legends? When did this happen that this group of lost people took on this kind of mythos?
Right. So there are two, in my mind, there are two important stages. Stage mm-hmm. number one is right after, mm-hmm. right after the conquest of Samaria and the kingdom of Israel, okay, in Jerusalem, okay. Because the Jerusalemites, they live through they're in a very interesting position. They watch everything that goes on in the north. Mm-hmm. They're fully aware of what is going on in the north, okay. In fact, in 701, Sennacherib, who is the next Assyrian king, lays a siege in Jerusalem. In Jerusalem. Yeah. Okay. Now he fails, and you know, in his steles, by the way, it's very interesting. If you read the steles, he's kind of sheepishly trying to make up some sort of story. But apparently, there was some sort of a military defeat. That, of course, in the Bible, it says that the angel of God struck the Assyrian army right after Jerusalem because you know all the Jerusalemites repented. Uh-huh. Okay, but they get to live through about 50 years where they see their rich northern kingdom being destroyed by the Assyrians and some of its people exiled. And, they are the one who are left to tell the story because we don't have the Israelite narrative. We don't have the narrative of the 10 tribes themselves before they come lost.
Right.
Those who tell us about them are the Jerusalemites. You know, these are the priests and the prophets, Isaiah. Okay, Isaiah and Jeremiah and so on. And what they do is when the Bible is rewritten, you know, not is rewritten, but basically written during this period, okay, what you have is a reworking of the story.
Yeah.
Okay, the mundane story of, okay, there was a siege, there was a war, the kingdom was lost, and part of the people was exiled. Yes. And now you have a reworking of the story that, you know, here you have a group of sinners who sinned against God,
right,
and they were punished for their sin, and all of them were gone, okay? Mm-hmm. Because God cannot really give you any partial punishment unless he says this is going to be a partial punishment. But, you know, the Jerusalemites and the prophets, they write it as a very big thing. The way in which you can tell this is, for example, because the narrative in Kings 2, in 2 Kings, is much more of kind of a semi-historical narrative. It talks about the various stages of the Assyrian wars until the conquest of Samaria, okay? But in Isaiah and in Hosea and in Amos, you know, which are the prophets that are dealing with that event, okay, and they are written very short time afterwards, and we know that because they do not discuss, you know, the events that happened in Jerusalem afterwards. They just focus on the north. They do say that everybody was exiled, okay, and they do try to deal with that. Also, we have to remember that this is the first time that something like this happens. This is way before the Babylonian exile. So the prophets in Jerusalem, they don't only have to tell the story, they have to deal with it. Mm-hmm. They have to say, okay, what does it mean that, you know, suddenly an empire comes and takes the people away? Okay, how are we going to tell that? And not only that, how are we going to tell that in a way that serves our own political and religious purposes? You know, because what we're really interested to show that this was not just a story of an empire. This was a punishment by God.
Yeah.
Okay, so the whole thing is reworked and the whole thing is dramatized far more to a story of, you know, the whole 10 tribes going away. This is how they become lost at the first stage. The second stage occurs centuries later, yes, when you have the return from Babylon of the Babylonian exiles,
right,
from the people of Jerusalem who are returning in 518 BC, okay? These people, you know, they build the second temple, and they have to contend with a new story, okay? Mm-hmm. The story is this. Since Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel promise a return, okay, and they insist on the return that the return will be full, okay, Ephraim, the staff of Ephraim and the staff of Judah will be returned together, join hand together. This will be the return, is supposed to be a full return. But what happens in the book of Ezra is it's not a full return. It's a return that occurs only two tribes, because the book of Ezra that talks about this return from Babylonia talks only about the tribes of Judah and Benjamin.
Can I ask you a question about those staffs? Yeah. You mentioned the staff of Ephraim and the staff of Judah. Yeah. How are those staffs commonly defined? What is a staff?
A staff is basically a staff. Okay, it is what you hold in your hand. The shepherd holds in your hand. Moses and Jesus is what they hold in their hand. Okay, but it also in biblical Hebrew, a staff also means or functions as basically a tribe or a group of people that are associated with the tribe. And when they talk about, for example, building the Mishkan, yes, which is the first dwelling of God in the desert of Sinai, they don't talk about the tribe of Judah, but they talk about the staff of Judah and the staff of Ephraim and the staff of Manasseh and the staff of, you know, Dan and all those people. I mean, in a way, in modern Hebrew, by the way, when you talk about staff, it's like actually chief of staff. When you talk about chief of staff or, you know, the staff is... It's the same usages, both in English and in Hebrew today.
The reason I ask, I was fishing a little bit, because in the Mormon culture, when they're talking about the staff of Judah and the staff of Ephraim, they're talking about scripture. I mean, they define it as scripture, that these two books will be brought together, and there will be a book of Ephraim and a book of Judah that's brought together.
That's a very interesting point, because I think when we get to Mormonism, at least in its early stages, what you have is a further significant elaboration on all these words, okay, and it's like a further significant elaboration on the story of loss, okay.
Right.
But just to begin to come back to what I was talking before,
sure.
I mean, what happened is that, you know, when the 10 tribes do not return. In a way, they become lost again. Mm. Because then they leave us with the question, what happened?
Yeah.
Okay. How come that, you know, the return promised by Isaiah and Jeremiah and Ezekiel, okay, before and after the Babylonian exile, what happened? Why did they not come? Where were they when Cyrus the Great says, I asked, God has given me the land, and now the Jews should return to Jerusalem and build the temple there. Okay. At that point, you have the final element of loss. Okay. That happens, that added to the story. Because now they are truly lost. Not only that they were lost because they were first exiled in 721 BC from Samaria. Now they're lost because they didn't come back. Mm-hmm. Okay. And that means that now Jews, and soon after that, Christians are going to be asking the question, it's like, not only why did they come back? And now, because now it's like, okay, if they didn't come back, where are they now? Mm-hmm. And when the messianic story develops, in turbulent times, you have the rise of Alexander, the rise of the Roman Empire, and then the rise of Christianity, there's a lot of messianic bubbling there, okay? Then the story becomes more and more elaborated. And in fact, in the earlier stages, people begin to talk about the fact that, if there's going to be a final return, that all the Jews, okay, or let's say all Israel, because Israel now means both Jews and what would be Jews and would be Christians, you know, when all Israel is united, what is going to happen with the 10 tribes? Are they going to come back or are they not going to come back? And it is very interesting because if you read the various literatures, okay, in the Apocrypha and in the early on, the first debate that in what later becomes the Jewish Talmud, okay, it's not very clear. Different people hold different positions. Some insist that they are not going to come back. Okay, they said that's it. They are gone and they are not coming back. This is a new category of people. People who were exiled by God and they are never going to come back. Okay. Other people insist that they will be coming back.
Right.
Okay. In the Apocrypha, it is very strong, this insistence.
Yeah.
Later on in Christianity and in Judaism, you have different strands that do insist that they come back. For example, in Judaism, you have the Talmud debating this for a while and then they say, so-and-so said that they are not going to come back, but we do not agree with him. Okay. It will come back. Now, Mormonism in that regard represents the most radical approach that talks about a return of the lost tribes. But when we come to Mormonism, this is already the Messianic age is a true unification of all humanity.
Yeah.
I mean, this is how I read it.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about the Apocrypha and Ezra. Who was Ezra, and where does he fit in the first and the second narrative of lost tribes that you just mentioned?
Okay. One very, very clear, very simple definition of what is the Apocrypha is that, you know, books that are basically biblical material, but for all sorts of reasons that we cannot go into them now, you know, are not part of the the biblical canon. Okay. Yet they carry some weight, particularly with certain Christian denominations, less with Jewish tribes, but more with Christian denominations. In fact, but that doesn't mean they did not represent Jewish voices or voices that existed and thoughts that existed in Jerusalem at the time. Okay. So one way to read them is that they are basically part of the picture. Uh-huh. They are not something that does not belong in the picture. They certainly belong in the picture. Okay. Because the picture is always greater than just what we have as the canon itself. Just as, you know, in Christianity, I mean, what we have, you know, the accepted gospel is always just part of it. There are more gospels that we're not included. Mm-hmm. Okay. But we have to read them as part of the picture. So the book of Ezra is an apocrypha in the sense that its author, who was a Palestinian Jew who lived in Jerusalem, shortly after the destruction of the temple by the Romans, he writes this book, but he writes the book not, because he wants to glorify himself. He wants to attach the book to a biblical figure that carries a great deal of weight, because he wants the book to carry the same weight. Okay. So he says that person becomes, that person is Ezra, the biblical Ezra, the Ezra that leads the Babylonian exiles back to Jerusalem after Cyrus, the king of Persia, the great Persian emperor, proclaims that the Jews should return to Jerusalem and build the temple.
Okay? How much time has passed? How much time has passed from the time he's writing this story and it actually happened?
Easily. How much time since Ezra, since the return?
Well, several hundred years from the time that he's writing it to when it actually happened.
Yes. He writes this 500 years after.
Okay.
Okay.
Right.
So what he does is two things. Okay. By the time that he writes the book, the biblical book of Ezra already exists, and it's already known, and it's almost canonized by that time. It's almost considered as part of the canon. Okay. Now he writes this apocryphal book and he calls it the Book of Ezra. Okay. And it's supposedly simply a lost part of the book of the canon of the biblical book. It's supposed to be a book that written by Ezra himself. Mm-hmm. Okay. But it is not Ezra. It's pseudo Ezra writing about 500 years after the events involving Ezra, and several hundred years, less than 500, after the book of Ezra itself was written.
Okay.
But it pretends to be simply a different part of the same book, of the biblical book.
Is it a creation of the author, or is it like oral tradition that's been passed down over the years? Do we know that? Yeah.
We can't tell, but almost for sure you can say that this is oral tradition that somehow, you know, got reworked at that moment.
Okay.
Because he was working with stories that probably were floating around for a while and then he put them to writing.
Okay.
Okay. So what he wants to do is three things. First, as I explained, he wants to attach the book to a known and recognized biblical canonical book. That's the Book of Ezra. So he attaches that. That's why he gives it the name, the Book of Ezra. Okay. The second thing that he does, he wants to solve all sorts of mysteries or all sorts of holes that the Book of Ezra leaves open. Okay. And for the sake of our discussion, the main thing that is left open is, where are the 10 tribes? How come Ezra doesn't bring them back? Okay. How come they don't come back with Ezra? Okay. And here we now know, because it is as if, you know, as if you and I are now traveling in time and we go to meet Ezra, I mean, the real Ezra. And we say, when you came back from Babylonia, why didn't you come back only with two tribes? And he says, okay, let me tell you, this is something that I didn't write in my book, but I wrote it in another book.
Yeah.
Okay. And here's the deal. Okay. The 10 tribes actually moved further on because they had all sorts of problems after their exile, and God took them to a different place and he opened the rivers for them. He shut them down behind another river, and that's where they are right now. They are in a different country. I'm going to come back to it in a second. They are in another land,
right.
And they will come back. I promise you that they will come back.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
They will come back in a different time.
Right.
Okay. Now, if you read it in the context of the first century after the destruction of the temple, okay, you really realize what the anonymous author of the book of the second book or the apocryphal book of Ezra is trying to do. He says, look, you know, I'm writing it for the people who are now in Jerusalem as a consolation. Okay. As a consolation. Mm-hmm. The 10 tribes will come back. Okay. We will come back. We will be restored.
Right.
Okay. What Titus just did to our temple, you know, that's not the end of the story.
Yeah.
Okay. And in order to show you that, you know, let me write you a book that will be attached to the great Ezra. Mm-hmm. Okay. And they will be promised the return of the 10 tribes.
Did they read it as if Ezra had seen all of this in vision, or how was the original Ezra supposed to have come by this knowledge?
He had a vision.
Okay.
He had a vision. And then it's a very interesting part. I mean, I have to say something about this. I wrote the book. I wrote it almost, it was almost a third bigger than there is one now. And there were all sorts of things that I had to leave out because it was simply too big.
Too big, yeah.
Okay? And another part that I compare is that, and I recommend to the listeners, if they want to do this trick, read the book of Ezra. And you see how the book of Ezra, which is, by the way, is dramatized as a mini Exodus. There's a scene there that Ezra is actually breaking a river. Mm. Just as Moses broke the Red Sea,
right.
There's a break of river. In the book of the apocryphal book of Ezra, the whole story of the exile of the further exile of the 10 tribes to their new place, yes, is simply told in the reverse. In the sense that there a river is broken by God, okay, and this river is broken just so the 10 tribes can pass to the new land where they are right now, mm-hmm. yes, and then this river is closed. So in a way, the apocryphal book of Ezra is masterfully crafted in the sense that it tells a reverse story to the story told of the return of the two tribes. Okay. So you can imagine that basically what is Ezra trying to tell you is like there was a movement in two directions. Mm-hmm. One direction is of the two tribes returning to Jerusalem, and another movement is the 10 tribes moving in another direction, yes. further away.
And,
okay.
And
this
did,
is what he
did. Did Ezra specify the direction? Did he say north?
It says north, and it says all sorts of things there. It says like he says it took him a year and a half to go.
Right.
Okay. And you should assume that if they are now somewhere in Asia, in Mesopotamia, and the movement of the two tribes is towards Jerusalem, that means they move west.
Yeah.
Then the 10 tribes must move east. Okay, and they are already east, so they should move further east in the story. Okay, so they simply would move further east. And we have to remember that all of this is in a geography that already Alexander the Great created.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is the geography that they know. So today it's very difficult for us to understand that because we know that there is a globe and the geography of the world is completely revealed to us. But if you write a story in the second century, what you imagine is something further east, which, and further east here means beyond the limits of the Empire of Alexander. That means beyond India. Mm-hmm. That is China.
So this is when you've got the land of, and I probably don't know how to pronounce it, Arzareth.
Yes.
And the Sambadion River and Prestrudion,
yes.
and these things.
Yes. So this is the second part. Okay. The Eretz Acheret in Hebrew means another land. And this is a verse in Deuteronomy that says, God shall cast them away and put them in another land, Eretz Acheret. Now, what happens is that in the original book, apocryphal book, that was probably written by someone who knew Hebrew, he says, they are now, the 10 tribes are now, he says, I see them in the vision, and they are now in this Eretz Acheret. Okay. But what happened is that the book is quickly translated into Greek. And in Greek, they take the adjective, another land, yes, and they turn it into a noun because they put the words together and they say, this is Artzaret, yes? Yes. That is why, by the way, in Jewish tradition, this whole Artzaret business never took off. No one uses it.
Yeah.
No. In Jewish tradition, everybody clung to the river, okay? But everybody knew, you know, that this Artzaret business cannot be. It's simply Eretz Acheret. It means, it's two words that mean another land. And another land here is another land. It's not an entity that is called another land.
Right.
Okay. But in Greek, they simply think that's the name of the land.
Yeah.
That's the name of the place.
Yeah.
Okay. It's not a signifier. It's simply the name of, the name of the place. So this is how it come to be. And only in the 19th century, a British scholar of the Bible comes up in this and says, hey, you know, you're all crazy. It's not, Artzaret is not a land with that, this is the name. It's simply a distortion of the Hebrew word, another, of the two words in Hebrew, which mean another land.
So he figures it out.
Yeah, he figures it out. But it's amazing that it takes 1900 years to figure.
Because by then there's been a lot that's been embellished in this story, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Seriously embellished.
Yeah.
I mean, not only the seriously embellished. I mean, first of all, in the Christian reworking of the story of Esdras, it is Jesus who breaks the river and let them go. In a way, it's easy to understand that this, what we have here is a reverse Exodus. Mm-hmm. Okay. The story of Exodus, Moses breaks the Red Sea so you can move into the promised land. Here you have a story that, you know, people are exiled and a river is broken so they can move into their new place of exile.
Yeah.
Okay. Where they have to stay until the end of time.
Yeah.
Okay. And that place of exile happens to be in the end of the world, in the literal geographic end of the world. Okay. And so on and so forth. Okay. So this is, by the way, why the story is very, very powerful. Okay. Just as Exodus is powerful. Okay. This is also very, very powerful. But it is always suppressed because it is an Exodus in reverse.
And so the main power that you're referring to here is this power of loss, right?
It's lost, but lost in the sense that you can find, in the sense that it is something that, always pushes you to find, to look for and to search.
Yeah.
Okay. It is not, lost is something that is gone, and you know, you have two types of loss. Lost, you say, okay, lost and is never coming back. But this is a different type of loss. This is lost of something that is going to come back. Okay. That is somewhere right now, as we speak, you know, somewhere, as we speak, you know, the 10 lost tribes are there and we can find them and we can bring them back. And when they are brought back, this is the sign that, you know, humanity is redeemed.
Yeah. Okay. Let's skip over centuries and get to sometime in the 17th century. You mentioned that England became kind of a hot spot of debate for the location of the lost tribes.
Yes. Several things about England. Okay. England, it comes right out. It's the empire that, you know, in many ways succeeds the Portuguese and the Spaniards in the Americas. Mm-hmm. Okay. The Portuguese and the Spaniards had their own little, phase where they thought that, you know, the people that they find in the Americas are the lost tribes, because basically all humanity is biblical humanity, and all the people that you find in the world should be mentioned in the Bible. Mm-hmm. What happens when you find people who are not mentioned in the Bible? Oh, so that's the solution that they bring, is that these people are the 10 tribes.
When the Portuguese and the Spanish are exploring the New World and they're coming to the edges of the known world, that's where they expect to find the lost tribes, right? So they have developed the American Indian Israel theory.
Yes, that's the beginning of it. Here's the thing. The thing is that not everybody says that these are the 10 tribes. Some people say that they are not. Mm-hmm. Okay. But, what I'm saying is that since, you know, you take the Bible to be the point that represents all humanity, because everybody is a descendant of Noah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Then every people that you find at the age of discovery, The first question that they ask, or one of the first questions that they ask, are these people the lost tribes?
Yeah.
Okay. And the most interesting example for this is the Canary Islands, because the Canary Islands were discovered first, and they discovered about several decades before the Americas were discovered. The Spaniards discovered the Canary Islands, and already then, the first question that they ask, are these people the lost tribes? Okay. And it is interesting because the reason why they refuted the story about the Canary Islands, the Canary Islands islanders cannot be the lost tribes because they are too close to Assyria, to the capital of Assyria. Mm. Therefore, in the book of Ezra tells us of a travel that they traveled a year and a half. Mm. Okay. So someone calculated the time that it would take them to go from the capital of Assyria to the Canary Islands. It says it's too close.
Too close. Okay.
Yes. And by the way, there is a some early Mormons, like Oliver Pratt, do the same calculation.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
They calculate they do the same method that, you know, the Spaniards are doing in the 16th century for the Canary Islands.
Yeah.
But in the case of the Spaniards, you know, there's all sorts of stories they're involved there, and they do toy, you know, some people say these are the lost tribes and some people say they are not. And the main question, the main issue here is that the issue is this being discussed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And it doesn't really matter who says yes and who says no. The question is, the main point is that people are discussing it. Okay. When it comes to England, there are several things going on in England at the same time. First of all, England used to be for a very long time the edge of the world. You know, if like the western edge of the world is England. In addition to that, England is an island. I mean, it's a group of islands. Okay. And there is a consciousness about the fact that, you know, we are living in islands and we are living in the islands of the edge of the world. Okay. Later on, it becomes more and more serious. But when they do this, they have their moment of the discovery of the Americas. Okay. They do it with a new religious impetus. Okay. This is already, you know, versions of Protestantism, unlike the Spanish Catholicism. There's a much deeper knowledge of the Bible as well. Okay. England comes in where, you know, there's a height of literacy. The Bible is much more accessible to people. The Bible is already translated. There's the King James translation and other translations. Okay. In the case of Spain, the Bible is still in Latin. And those who engage the Bible and the stories in the Bible, and therefore the story of the lost tribes, are usually clergy, and they are very few and very educated people.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. In the case of this is the elite, but in the case of England, you have a much wider group of people who can engage the Bible and can interpret this, you know, free of, you know, any, elite interpretation. You know, they don't need the church or they don't need some priest to interpret the Bible for them. They can look at the history. They can look at the world of the geography of the world and they can interpret this for themselves.
Yeah.
Okay. And one of the interesting things that happened in England, is that, you know, since the discovery of America, the English discovery of America, okay, and the colonization of North America is the most dramatic story, perhaps in English history, if you think about it.
Yeah.
I mean, the creation of the colonies,
right.
And so on. That's the most dramatic story that really changes the British history forever. Okay. And it is done by people who are deeply religious.
Yeah.
And not only deeply religious, they're deeply religious in the sense that, you know, they really think and they truly believe, you know, that their colonization of America is an event of biblical measure. Okay. So when they inherit the question of the Native Americans, whether they are not the 10 tribes and all, they think about it in much more deeper ways. Okay. And already in the late 16th century, in the beginning of the 17th century, they come up with a much more powerful story. Okay. In a way, it matters less whether the Native Americans are the true descendants of the lost tribes. Yes. In a way, it matters more that they are metaphorically the lost tribes, because then bringing them to Christianity,
mm-hmm.
is not simply that you go and you preach the gospel to people to some innocent native,
right.
unsuspecting people.
Yeah.
What you're doing is an act of restoration.
Right.
Is an act of bringing back.
Yeah.
Okay. And now you are really a tool of the great prophets. What you're doing is you bring back the people. This is when, and you know, you can imagine, 17th century English people, you know, when they go and they preach to the Native Americans, it's much nicer to think of yourself as someone who is actually doing something the way the great prophets prophesied. You know, you are actually participating in the great prophecy of bringing the people back.
Right.
Okay. And I think that the moment that this interpretation comes, okay, as opposed to the Spanish one, the Spanish were more interested to say, well, are they the 10 tribes or are they not? Because we're really interested in understanding, you know, the biblical story. Okay. In the English phase, okay, the story is not only whether they are the lost tribes or they are not. That's just kind of a yes or no question. The story is now, what is the meaning of this story? What does it mean? Because if it means that they are the lost tribes, then when we bring them back to Christianity, we're actually partaking in a great messianic story.
Yeah.
Just as Isaiah said that all of them will become back. Just as Ezekiel said, you know, the staff of Ephraim and the staff of Judah will come back together. This is what we're doing.
Now, did any of these British people speculate that they themselves were remnants of the lost tribes?
Yes. This is why I strategically mentioned the fact that they were already at the edge of the world and they are the island of the sea. Okay. Because that happens a lot later. Okay. And this could bring us to the moment where, you know, what happened to when the theory that the Native Americans are the lost tribes, what happens when this theory is basically exhausted and frustrated? Mm-hmm. Because what happened is that for several hundred years, people insisted, you know, people say, well, they're the lost tribes. They try to find evidence for that. Okay. In all sorts of ways. They try to read Mexican art and they say, look, you know, it looks like Hebrew. They do all these ethnographies of various, Native American tribes. And they say, well, you know, I mean, the language here resembles Hebrew and the customs that they do, you know, this is what they do. And you have all sorts of people. Okay. Just as, you know, people later on go to find the, all sorts of things. They say, people put money and they raise money and they say, okay, we're going to find the lost tribes.
Yeah.
And they go to the Americas and they write these great books, ethnographies of Native American tribes and trying to interpret their cultures as if, you know, it shows traces of ancient Hebrew culture.
Yeah.
Okay. But at some point, this is over because the mounting evidence is that what you have here is Native American culture is simply Native American culture. It's nothing that we know. Okay. Yeah. You cannot tie it back to Jerusalem.
Yeah.
And that moment is like you need to break this because that moment you have two things there. You have science or archaeology or ethnography and anthropology, and linguistics also that keeps telling you, listen, guys, these are not the lost tribes. You have to calm down with this.
Yeah.
Okay. So then what do you do? Okay. What do you do? You have two options. You know, when you have faith clashes with science.
Yeah.
Okay. Or clashes with reality. Sometimes what you need is a new revelation.
Yeah.
Okay. Sometimes what you need is a new prophet. Okay. And this produces two types of prophets. Okay. The first one is a crazy person who is British, I can diss on British Israelis. So I say he's crazy because he was also institutionalized.
Yeah,
okay. His name is Richard Brothers. And Richard Brothers is a Canadian English. Okay. It's important that he comes from Canada. Okay. He comes from Canada. He returns to England. And he, fights in different wars and so on. And then at some point he becomes a little bit mentally unstable. And he is literally hospitalized in a mental institution in England. And he begins to write. Missives and letters and books and prophecies in which he does all sorts of things. He does a political analysis of the situation in Europe. And he says, basically what we have here is a beginning of the end. This is all repetition of a preparation for some sort of a second coming and a revelation.
Yeah. Okay.
Then in addition to that, he reworks all sorts of English local traditions that say, actually, you know, we are related to Israel. Some of us are descendants of the family of Jesus. Richard Brothers himself claims that he's related to Jesus. And so on and so forth. You know, a certain tendency among some English people to identify themselves with Israel, with the idea of Israel. Okay. Literally. Okay. And then, you know, he comes out of this. He never says that actually the English people are descendants of the Ten Lost Tribes. He never says this directly. Mm-hmm. But my argument is that but nevertheless, you know, as I show in the book, the fact that he doesn't really say it literally and directly doesn't mean anything. What's important for us is how it is received. Yeah. And it is received as if he's saying that. And the audience outside the mental institution in London is ready to receive this as, I mean, not everybody, but is ready to say, okay, you know, what he's really saying is that we are the Ten Lost Tribes. We, the English people. And from that moment on, all the way through the 20th century, through the 19th century and the 20th century, there is a new strand within Anglo-Saxon Christianity that makes the following arguments. So first of all, the people in the English Isles are descendants of the Ten Lost Tribes. England is the true another land. This Artaret, this land, this new place of exile that God took the 10 tribes is in fact England. Okay. And from that moment on, once you have this in place, all you need to do is just reread the Bible in a way that proves your point. Okay. So now you have all sorts of people who say, let me show you that I'm right. Okay. So they take the Bible and they say, you see here that Isaiah says that the lost tribes will be coming back from the island of the sea. That means that they are now in the islands of the sea. And wait, what are the islands of the sea if it's not England?
Right.
Okay. Yeah. Then he says that, you know, they will be all over the place. And then people say, well, isn't the English Empire all over the place?
Yeah.
Okay. And so on. And then you have, for example, you have this interesting guy in the 19th century. This is already 100 years after Richard Brothers. Okay. Edward Pyne.
What was it? Can you give me a date for Richard Brothers? When was it?
This is late. This is before, just before this is 1780s.
Okay.
Okay. So I'm already in the 19th century, well into the 19th century. You have people, some of them are anonymous, but some of them like reveal themselves in name. For example, Edward Hine. And Edward Hine, he becomes crazy with this. He says, like, all I think about is the fact that I need to prove to the English people that we are the Lost Tribes, that we are the descendants of the Lost Tribes. So he writes a book and he says, 17 identifications of the English people with the Lost Tribes. Yeah. Okay. And then he writes another book, which is 47 identification. Okay. Yeah. He keeps coming back with all sorts of clues in the Bible.
Right.
That prove that the English people are the lost tribes.
These are things like a lion and a unicorn as part of the royal family seal and that sort of thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, Glenn, what is going on here is a much fascinating story, if you ask me, than the Da Vinci Code.
Okay? Yeah, right.
What we have here is a serious, serious story about the origin of the Europeans, particularly the origin of the Anglo-Saxons, the origins of the English people. He writes, he's not the only one, but it's a new biography. It's a new genetic and religious biography of the English people, both in England and in North America.
Yeah.
Okay. And this biography is powerful on three things. First of all, it tells you, it rewrites the English past. Mm-hmm. Okay. It also explains the English present because it says, look, you know, all these great prophecies of Isaiah, that's the empire. Yeah. That's what we're doing. We're not just expanding in the world. We are really enacting the great story. When he says, you know, when Isaiah speaks about all of people from all over the world will come to the center, that's us.
Yeah.
Okay. And then it also charges the British history with the messianic power.
Yeah.
Okay. Because if we are the descendants of true Israel, okay. First of all, it makes us better Christians.
Yeah.
Okay. Second of all, you know, look, we have this great destiny.
Yeah.
Okay. The destiny that of the blessing of that Jacob gave to Ephraim. So here we come back into this idea of the another line of chosenness.
Yeah.
Another line of chosenness. In Richard Brother himself, you know, I think that one of the reasons that he hesitated to say that he comes from Ephraim, because he also insisted to say that he's related to Jesus.
Oh, okay. Right,
yeah. And if you are related to Jesus, you have to be from the house of David.
Right.
You have to be from the house of David. You can't be that. Yeah. Okay. So there are two stories they're fighting together, but somehow they come together. And there are two issues there that I will finish with British Israelism is that First, they say, you know, Ephraim has an older brother who gets a lesser blessing. If you read the book of Exodus, so he gets a lesser blessing. So first, in the 19th century, when England is at the top,
Manasseh, right?
Yes, Manasseh.
Blessing. Okay.
Yeah, he gets a lesser blessing. So they say first, England is Ephraim. Okay, England is Ephraim's kingdom. Okay, and the United States is Manasseh.
Okay.
After World War One, okay, the story is reversed. Since England is in decline and the United States is on the rise, then you have all sorts of Canadian and North American theologians of British Israelism that argue the reverse. That they say, well, United States is Ephraim and Manasseh is England. Okay, they get the lesser blessing because now the prophecies have to fit, you know, the changing geopolitical.
Right.
Yes, yeah. The turf. Okay? So, but the story is that what you have here is a revelation. Okay. It's a very, very powerful one. Okay. And it's a very interesting. If you read 19th century, I could not, you know, I really wanted to. I have to write another book just right. about this part of it because yeah. they really work it really nicely. For example, some of the people, I didn't mention them in the book, but I, in this version of the book, you know, some of the people, they say, well, you know, the Germans are not really part of the story. Mm. Okay. And in a way, why the insistence that the Germans are not part of the story? Because, you know, there is an enmity between England and Germans.
Yeah.
So, you know, they are not part of this.
Right.
Okay. Because what they end up doing is they rewrite the whole history of all the European peoples. Mm-hmm. Okay. Because part of, very important part of European history is that the Europeans migrated to Europe. Okay. So what you want is to create a new pedigree, a very distinguished pedigree of chosen people, to them. Some branches of the British Israelism ended up by saying basically, declaring basically that the Jews, you know, the Jews, who are known as Jews are actually not part of the story at all. Okay. And they are the true part of it. And you can go on, and there are really interesting, funny things. For example, a certain book about British Israel theology is coming out in England. So it talks about the glory of England.
Yeah.
Okay. But when the same book comes out in Canada, the title is a little different and it talks about the glory of the Anglo-Saxons.
Okay.
Because the Anglo-Saxons, you can find both sides of the Atlantic, but England is only one England and it's in England. Okay. And so on and so forth. Mormonism in this regard, and I hasten to make it very clear that the two phenomena are not related. Okay. It's not the same. They're not related in any way, but they're related only in the sense that they are revelatory responses mm-hmm. to the frustration of the Native American theory. When this theory is completely frustrated and you cannot really prove that the Native Americans are, what you do now is like you look for the lost tribes, other words. And in this regard, Mormonism is a similar reaction to the Mysteries of the Lost Tribe story, but it's a very, very different reaction from the British Israel reaction. Mormonism, the way I read it, says, well, you know, I mean, we cannot really try to the scientific route to prove that the Native Americans are the descendants of the Lost Tribes. What we need is a new book, a new revelation. Okay. And here I think part of the reason that the Mormonism is very powerful, okay, is they take the story of Lost, they make the story of Lost and the theology of Lost and the theology of restoration of Lost a central piece in Mormon theology, but they also make something that I think Americans always wanted, to have America included in the biblical narrative, because yeah. America is not part of the biblical narrative. But here now, with the Book of Mormon, you can make that happen, okay? And it cannot be happening in a scientific, modern, rational story. What you need is a new, powerful, prophetic voice, just as the great prophets of the Bible themselves, you know, who come in and, you know, reality doesn't really matter. What matters is that what powerful story you can produce. And this is when, you know, I think this is the moment that, you know, Mormonism is born. I mean, of course, we're not trying to here to write history of Mormonism, and I'm not trying to be an expert on Mormonism, but right. I'm saying
this is how it fits into this cultural world history that you're
yes.
looking at. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. And one of the things that is happening, and if you read the book, you see that there is a just before the appearance of Smith, of Joseph Smith, yes, there's a series of books that are coming out in America. Mm-hmm. To try to prove that the Americans are the Native Americans are the Lost Tribes, or they are the Hebrews. Right. Okay, and there is one book by Ethan Smith called "The View of the Hebrews" that is people say that's the book that convinced that triggered Joseph Smith to come with his revelations. Right. I am not necessarily sure. That happens to be one book that came out just before Joseph Smith appeared. Mm-hmm. Okay, on the scene. But it is not necessarily this particular book, because this culture was there all the time. I mean, two very important things. One is the desire to find the lost tribes. Yeah. And two is the desire to make America part of the biblical story, mm-hmm. which was, by the way, shared by many Americans, not only by Americans that believed in the lost tribe story or Americans who became later on part of the Mormon religion. I mean, even Americans today, when you have people, evangelical people, talk about America as the promised land, talk about America as the most important, greatest nation under the Lord and so on. That's kind of, the same thing, trying to make America part of this biblical story that is not only a story that was one written and therefore you can write any new chapters to it anymore. You can write new chapters to it, but right. As long as you say that they are not really new, that they always existed and you're just discovering them.
Yeah.
Now, the reason why I say that there is the reason why I mentioned this, the moment of the birth of Mormonism as a revelatory response to the moment where, the scientific attempts to prove that the Native Americans were the lost tribes, has to do with the moment that I discovered, is written about them. Because there's this guy whose name is Rafi Nisk. And he's a polyglot. He has his own, he's one of those, early rationalists. You can't call him an atheist exactly, but he thinks that, religion is a stupid thing, full of superstition. He believes in science, and he has this own journal where he angrily attacks all sorts of people who believe in all sorts of stupid things.
Yeah.
Okay. And then he writes this little story where he attacks, he ridicules an Irish lord named Lord Kingsborough. Okay. And Lord Kingsborough was a young man who wasted all his money on Mexican art.
Right.
All his money is like produced beautiful, volumes, of reproduction of pre-Columbian Mexican art. And his main thing was that he was trying to prove, to find clues in Mexican art to say, well, the Mexicans are the descendants of the lost tribes.
Right.
So Ravinesque says, look at him. Kingsborough ended up in Dublin, in the debtors' prison in Dublin. He lost all his money trying to prove that. The whole thing was gone, lost his estate, lost his money, his inheritance, everything, and then died in prison. Okay, because of this lost tribe craziness.
Yeah.
Okay, and Rafi Nisk in America, he says, look, this lost tribe craziness was brought to another peak by yet another guy who loses all his money trying to prove that they are the 10 tribes, wastes a lot of time on that, but that's nothing. Okay, there's a new outrage. He says there is a new group of people who have this Quran, and he calls it the Quran, like the Muslim book. Okay, just to show you what he thought about the Book of Mormon, who now they believe that they discovered the lost tribes. Okay, so and interesting, because at the moment of the birth of the first appearance of the Mormon group, mm-hmm. other people, at least this Rafi Nisk, who was a very educated man, okay, he lumps them together with a case of an Irish person who just loses all his money. Okay. And and for him, the two things are equally outrageous. Okay. The two things are equally connected to this superstitious craze that no one can explain. Why are people so obsessed with the lone tribe? Why do they try to find them? And I think it's very telling that for him, the appearance of the Mormons and the appearance of the, is lumped together with the appearance of the volumes of this Mexican art. Okay. I mean, these two things happened. They were completely disconnected from each other, but he saw them as coming of the same tradition, of the same mood.
Yeah.
And he lumped them together.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm curious about how the story of the Lost Tribes has changed, and maybe there's always been this kind of dual emphasis: one, that the tribes are lost because they're scattered among us and we don't know who they are anymore, they've kind of lost their identity, and the other, that they're in a certain place that's hidden away, yet to be found. Mm-hmm. And as we're getting further along in the story, we're running out of lost lands.
Yes. Yeah. So this is interesting, because what happens is that you think, okay, as long as we didn't really know the geography of the world before Columbus, before the great discoveries of Australia, Africa, the Cape of Good Hope, and so on, there were plenty of candidates. Okay. Since the world was quite limited, you can always place them in a certain beyond. But once the age of discovery, you think, okay, you know, well, we're going to discover everywhere, and then that's it. So there are different reactions to this. First of all, it causes a certain crisis. Okay. Some people say, well, you know, there's no longer, we've discovered all the world. We exposed all the world. We didn't find the lost tribes. It's all been a hoax, and there are no lost tribes. Okay. So that's one development. You can say, well, this is the mainstream, most of the people today. Okay. Another way to deal with this is to say, well, just as you didn't know that America existed before you discovered it, there are other worlds out there that you don't know. And when you will discover them, you will call them new worlds. Okay. So the moment of discovery becomes a receding horizon. The moment we discover a new place, then they're going to be in another one. And that's not going to be the new one. There's always going to be a new place to discover. Okay. That also dies out at some point. But then the most important one, I think, is to say, well, the lost tribes are actually not in one place, and they are also not at the same way at the moment of their exile. They changed. They are all over the place, and they are hiding in other people. Okay. What we have now is a situation that the lostness of the tribes, it's not that they are really lost as human beings. They are found as human beings, but the 10 tribe element in them is lost. Is that, you know, some people say, well, at some point they say they've been heathenized. They became part of the savages and the heathens. But later on they say, well, you know, everybody could be a lost tribe.
Yeah.
Everybody in the world could be a lost tribe, except that they are lost in the sense that they don't know that they are lost.
Right, right. Yeah. Is that a more modern phenomenon in this, or has that been around for a while?
That's a more modern phenomenon.
Okay.
That cannot be before the 18th century.
Okay.
And in fact, more than that. It's almost, you can say it's a 20th century development in the sense that, you know, all the world is exposed. We discovered all the human groups. We discovered all the peoples. We even discovered all the tribes in the Amazon. You know, there are no more groups to discover. Mm-hmm. Okay. And at that point, when you say there are no more groups to discover, the story gets to rewritten. Now, instead of discovering new peoples, you're going to go to old peoples and say, in fact, you didn't know that, but you're descendants of the lost tribes. And that's very interesting. First of all, I think you see this happening in Mormonism. You also see it happening in, for example, Black American religions. I don't know if you ever go to New York, but every Saturday, if you go to New York, in Union Square, there's a group of of Black Americans who believe that they are the descendants of the lost tribes, and they rewrote the biography. Okay, you can find this also on the internet. You have all sorts of groups in Finland who say that the Finnish are descendants of those tribes, and you have even a group of Incans from the Inca who say, you know, Inca is the lost tribe. So and of course, plenty in Africa and in Asia. And the story here is what you do is you do the reverse. You go to a known group of people and you rewrite their history.
Right. Yeah, I found that a little bit with the Japanese and the, you know, the master's thesis that I wrote with Norman McLeod and some other things. So where do you see this curiosity with loss and restoration? Where do you see that active today?
And here I speak as an amateur, as a viewer. I think that, you know, part of the mission of Mormonism, even if it's not articulated in this way, but I think one of the reasons that it is one of the fastest growing religions today in the world is very active, is very energized. I think it's part of that. Okay. I'm sure that, you know, it's not very visible, but, you know, if, as I come out of this 2,700 years tradition of looking for lost tribes,
right,
this is what I see. Okay. In the sense that, you know, there's a great deal of energy in finding the lost. Okay. Another part is, what's going on in the state of Israel today, which is really crazy. In one way, you can say that, you know, you have different people, coming in and they say, we are descendants of lost tribes and they want citizenship. In some cases, you know, the government approves of that. Okay. And it's in the protocols of the Israeli parliament. In some places they reject that. They say that's not true. Okay. But if you look at Africa, there are many African tribes right now who claim, not many, but, you know, some African tribes now who claim that they are in fact descendants of the lost tribes. Okay. And that they are in some contact with some people in Israel. Mm-hmm. In Israel, there are also groups of people who are engaged in active search for the lost tribes. Mm-hmm. All of this is none of this is official. Some of it becomes official at some point. And people are talking about it. It even becomes, you know, a governmental decision. For example, the tribe of Menashe was found in the borders of Burma and Thailand. And some people were, quote unquote, repatriated and brought back to Israel. Okay.
How did they prove this claim of ethnicity of Israel lineage?
In fact, they never did. Okay. They never did. Yeah, the story was more, if you ask me, I think it has to do with all sorts of British adventurers who went to look for the lost tribes in this area. And, you know, kept asking the natives, are you the lost tribes? Until one guy decided to say, yes, we are. Okay. And because if let's say this, everybody, people come to you and say, like, do you light candles on the Saturday? Do you pray on the Sabbath? Do you avoid pork? At some point, you know, it becomes suggestive when you start doing this. Okay. And, you know, the state of Israel accepted some, and they also accepted some people in, from Peru. And these people were brought in and they converted regularly. I mean, they converted just anybody else, you know, would convert. But part of the reason, the impetus for the conversion was the conversion of these are really repatriated lost tribes who are now converting to Judaism and becoming Israeli citizens. And of course, there's placed in different places. There's a great deal of power in restoration.
Yeah.
Okay. We can see this in Portugal, where you have in Portugal and in New Mexico, where suddenly people say, well, we are descendants of the Jews who were forcibly converted to Catholicism during the time of the Inquisition, in the time of the, in the 15th century in Spain. So now I say we want to return. Okay. The idea of return is always much more powerful than simply going and discovering. It's like you return to something that you always knew you was yours.
Right.
Okay. I think it's very, very powerful in that. I think some Japanese, did find it very, very powerful also that, you know, the fact that they are in the edge of the world geographically, I mean, from one point of view, and the fact that they are islands, you know, makes it very nice for them to receive this story. And you can see all sorts of Japanese coming to Israel and, you know, being the idea that they are doing is that they're friends of Israel and so on. That's pretty much where you can see it active, but we can also say something about loss itself.
Yeah.
Okay. It's not necessarily the loss of the lost tribes. It's loss of all sorts of things. Okay. Things that you think that they were once there, and they are no longer there, but they should be there. For example, Atlantis. Okay. For example, the lost land of Lemuria, which is an Indian myth about a continent that sunk years before. Lost people today. I mean, the idea, that you bring something back, you know, that you restore something back is always very, very strong.
Yeah.
I think to people, it brings them completeness and wholeness, and so on. And there's something very beautiful in it. And, you know, it's okay, we're going to unite humanity this way.
Right. And if you can write yourself into the narrative of history as a restorer, you really grasp onto that power.
Yes.
I think you see a lot of that, with Mormonism. So if I could spend the last few minutes of our discussion, I'd be curious to tell you a little bit about some of the locations, you know, or some of the meaning of the lost tribes that, have been in the Mormon church over the last 100 years or so, and talk about some of the locations and just ask you if you've heard in of these locations being mentioned, throughout history. Sure. Or is this something that's unique to Mormon? So, I think I should probably mention that in 1916, so, you know, we're getting close to 100 years on this, there was a Mormon leader who prophesied that the lost tribes would return the way that it was prophesied in scripture, that they would come from the north and that they would be a group of people that would carry with them the treasures of Ephraim, and that they would bring those treasures into the group. And it's very interesting that they would talk about this because, you know, I mentioned earlier there's this dual vein in the lost tribes story where you've got a group of people in one place, but you also have the scattering that, you know, any one of us could be the lost tribes. And there's within Mormonism, every Mormon can get what's called a patriarchal blessing, where they have told to them, through revelation, which tribe they are a descendant of. And the overwhelming, revelation is that they're tribes of Ephraim. So Mormons have from the beginning with Joseph Smith and the early leaders associated themselves with Ephraim, but they've also held on very strongly to this belief that there is a group still out there somewhere. So in 1916, Talmadge gave this prophecy that the lost tribes would return. They would bring these records with them, and the records would tell of Jesus Christ's visitation to them in the meridian of time, and that there were people in the congregation that he was speaking to that would live to be able to read those records. So as we've gotten further along in history, where it looks more and more unlikely that that prophecy is going to come to pass, there have had to be alternative explanations as to where the tribes are, what it means to gather scattered Israel. And so you hear things about, and you mentioned this in your book, the tribes being someplace off of this world, on a section of earth that was removed from this earth, and that someday it will return to the earth and be joined. Is that a uniquely Mormon story, or is that something that you've heard other places?
Yeah, that, I mean, well, it's not a uniquely Mormon story. Mm. For instance, the only times that you can see the lost tribes actually presented on a map is in the 16th century, two maps. One is produced in Basel, is a map of Asia that simply puts in northeastern Asia, in would today be Siberia, just say they put the word outside. Then Abraham Ortelius was the most important cartographer of the period in the late 16th century. He attaches a whole peninsula sticking out north, in northeastern Siberia, and he really is a huge territory. He says that's Artsarat. Okay, that's the place where they are. Okay, and then they begin this whole. On top of his map, you have all these calculations of, you know, how they got to the Americas, and the North plays a great deal because then they say, well, you know, they traveled North, and here look at the prophecies that said they would be coming from the North. So they have to be in the North. So in fact, what I think Mormonism does, it comes on the heels of years of speculations that insisted that they are in the North.
Yeah.
Okay, particularly in Northeast Asia, because Northeast Asia is very close to the North Pole, A, and B, very close to Alaska and to the Americas.
Yeah.
Okay, and it is very interesting how it works, because when North America is not yet studied, so they say, well, Northeast Asia actually touches on Peru. Okay, because that's the thing that they know. Okay, this is the height of Spanish Empire. Only later, you know, they relocate it and they talk about the North being North, say the North Pole. Okay, but the other thing that I think Mormonism, at least in its early time, at least at the time that you're talking about, let's say in late 19th century and early 20th century, it tried to deal with this idea of a land that is part of this earth and not part of this earth.
Right.
Okay. And the way in which it is comes out is that there's always a little tweak. There's always a little wrinkle somewhere there. There's always a loophole. Okay. So the Mormon novel that I was describing by Lindelof, it's written in 1903.
Yeah.
And it locates the 10 tribes in the North Pole. Mm-hmm. Okay. But you can't get there. You can't just get there. There's always some accident that happens. And the accident that happens to them is that they take off from San Francisco in a boat. And then there is a storm and they get lost. It's, in other words, you can never get to the place where the lost tribes are by usual means. It always has to be, something that happens, you know, something that represents a geographical transformation.
Yeah. That's interesting. There's a modern day Lindelof who's writing a story called Lost. I don't know if you're familiar with the television show Lost, but it's a similar, you know, you can't get to this place unless there's some kind of an accident.
Oh, Glenn, I'm so glad you mentioned this. Yeah. You know, I mean, I'm trying now. I mean, this is exactly the story. The island. I've seen only two episodes, and then my wife, you know, she got bored with this, and you know, she did. I don't know how it is now, but it is a very annoying at the beginning because you never know what's going on. Right. They keep changing the story.
Yeah, okay? Yeah.
But the main thing there is that the island is off the radar.
Yeah.
Okay. So at the same time, it's part of this, it's part of our Earth, but at the same time, it's not.
Yeah.
Okay. And you can get there only because there is a little bit of an accident. There's a little bit of something going on. Okay. And if you look at all the stories of all the folklore about the lost tribes, it's always like this, you know, for example, in Jewish folklore, it's like someone was chasing his goat. Then the goat disappeared and he was going into a hole. And then he found himself in the lost tribe territory.
Right, right.
Someone ended up in China in a place where it is covered by a cloud and they were there, you know, yeah. And so on. And Lindelof, you know, he's, yeah. So in the story of Lost is very much the same, story in this regard.
Yeah.
Well, and the idea that off the radar and on the radar, but part right. of Earth and not of Earth and so on.
Yeah. So the first question that I asked, I might not have been clear enough that there are reports of Joseph Smith walking to someone, I think his name was Heber Brown or Homer Brown and pointed up to the North Star. And pointed out in space and said, do you see that star just below that? That's where the lost tribes are. And they were removed from this earth and they're out there in space. And someday there will be a collision with that world and this world. And it'll cause the mountains to shake and the earth to roll up like a scroll. Is that something that you've come across before? This kind of outside of like literally outside of this world? Or is it more like a metaphysical thing?
I think that, you know, I think that, Joseph Smith here was talking, but in three levels. One level, he's basically a prophet. And as a prophet, you can say things that don't make sense to, normal human beings.
Yeah,
okay. You can say, you know, I mean, once you are told that, once you are designated as a prophet, you know, you can really bend reality.
Yeah.
Okay. So for me, it's totally coherent and totally makes sense that the prophet would say something like this.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, in addition to that, I think that Smith is talking as a scientist, as a scientist geographer, knowing full well that the world is completely exposed, world geography is completely mapped. There is no peninsula attached to Asia like Ortelius. We know that there isn't. There is no tribes hiding there in the Amazon. We know that. So we now need to relocate them outside our Earth. Okay. In the sense here, what he's doing, that this prophecy that he's talking about, pointing to a star, is basically, a response to yet another scientific challenge, in this regard. And he's doing it again by his method, by coming up with a new revelation, a new knowledge that was revealed to him, not exposed through scientific inquiry, something that was revealed to him. On the third level, I think, and I discuss this a great deal in the book, I'm not sure that we have time to get into it now. I suspect that in the Jewish tradition, the river Sambation, that is ostensibly the river behind that locks the 10 tribes and separates them from our land, okay, from our earth, you know, that makes their land the other land, the ultimate other land, okay. I think it represents, you know, it comes from astrology and it represents, say, Saturn. Now, why Saturn? By the way, Sambation is basically a distortion of the word Sabbath, and Sabbath is the seventh day. And in ancient astrology, Saturn is the seventh planet. Mm-hmm. And of course, if you think about the word Sabbath in English, we say Saturday, and yeah. Saturday comes from Saturn. This is the day of Saturn. Okay, so there are all sorts of connections there. And one of the speculations that I put in my book is that Sambation, that river, okay, is in fact, it's not the river. It is simply the farthest place in the universe that you can imagine if you live in the second century AD, and that would be Saturn, okay, the orbit of the planet Saturn. Okay, that would be the farthest place you can imagine. So if Smith knew about that, then, you know, this is just show how, what a genius he was,
yeah.
And, you know, in weaving all sorts of stories and putting them together. Mm. And if he didn't know that, he was in fact echoing an ancient tradition that has yet to be fully exposed.
Wow.
And there is no, by the way, there's no dispute that there is a connection between Saturn and the Jews and Saturn and Messianism in this regard. I mean, this is, you can find also Roman historians are talking about it and so on. I mean, it was a widely believed thing.
Right. Well, I think that's probably a good place to wrap up. It's been fascinating, and I really enjoy the time getting on here for. I was budgeting an hour, it went an hour and a half. So,
thank you very much for inviting me.
Yeah, appreciate it. And maybe be in touch in the future as I'm writing sure. this review. If I have further questions, I'll let you know.
Sure thing.
All right.
Sure thing.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Take care.
Bye bye.
Bye bye.